Okay, so we've got today a quiz I kind of assume you're all going to get 100% on. The purpose for the quiz, as much as anything else, is just so you kind of get a feeling as to how these quizzes will work in the future. So the plan is I'm going to put up some dots on the screen. I'm going to call something constellation A, and you're going to write A equals some name of some constellation. And then we'll go on to constellation B. And I am trying to pick what I think are the easiest, the two easiest constellations to get. So this is constellation A. So write your name. A equals the name of that constellation. This particular constellation has a short name in addition to an official name. I don't care which you give me. Actually, I think that might be upside down. I suspect it's just as recognizable to you that way as the other way. It's all the difference in the world? Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go. Everyone's done with this guy, which I would call the easiest constellation. And here's what I would call the second easiest constellation. Constellation B. Anybody want to see them again? When they're harder, you probably will want to see them again. Okay, pass them this way. Make sure your names are on it. Did anybody feel challenged by that quiz? So the first constellation was Ursa Major. Big Dipper is what I would write. Any of them are fine. Second constellation?
Orion.
Orion. Okay. So everyone should get lots. 4 points. They get harder though, right? They get substantially harder. So we'll do these kind of every day until we have the exam, which is, I think, kind of in 2 weeks-ish. Yeah, happy birthday. And, well, after, I mean, your birthday, you don't party before, you study before, right? I hope. And probably maybe next Thursday we'll have what I call a big quiz that'll talk about spectra and telescopes and all of that sort of stuff. And it's again kind of to prepare you for the exam.
On what day is it?
It might be Thursday, but not the next class period. And so these so-called big quizzes are big enough that if you have a conflict, you should talk to me about it and we can work out something. You know, be like a 30-point quiz or something like that. Questions? Okay, so we've been talking about waves for a while, and we started with sound waves mostly because I think they're easier, but as a matter of fact, we will care about sound waves at the very end of this class. And in the context of sound waves, we distinguished two ways that the sound could be distributed. We could have like crowd noise, where we have lots of different people screaming at the same time with different voices. So we have a simultaneous superposition of lots of different wavelengths. So that's a continuous spectra. Or we could have something like an orchestra where just a few notes are being played. So in the context of light, which is where we were last time, we saw that an incandescent light bulb, which is a light bulb that is producing light just because it's hot, produce all the colors of the rainbow. And it produces a spectra that looks more or less like that. It has a peak at some particular wavelength. And what we saw was that as we increased the temperature, that wavelength shifted from long wavelengths to shorter wavelengths. So it went from red hot to white hot to conceivably blue hot, blue-white hot if we had a hot enough object. But the most obvious thing that happens when I change the temperature of those filaments is that it gets way brighter. So we get more light at every wavelength when you increase the temperature. And it turns out that the amount of light increases like temperature to the fourth, so that if you double the temperature, you get 16 times as much light. Okay, so here's a cool object. If we wanted to know how much light there was at a particular wavelength, which is the sort of thing we did at for the online quiz, you just go up and over in order to read the amount of light. The peak wavelength, this is the peak. The peak wavelength you would just determine by figuring out where that maximum is occurring. So these spectra are all graphs of the amount of light, in this case, versus the wavelength or frequency. It kind of doesn't matter which, but most commonly, in this course, I'll be plotting things as a function of wavelength. So actually, 2 times ago, we saw how you could make an absorption spectra, but we talked more about it last time. If we have a continuous source of light, like the sun or a light bulb, and we put something in front of it that just absorbs a few frequencies, then that particular wavelength will be missing. And instead of having the amount of light you would expect, you would have substantially less amount of light. So the sun's light is going through the sun's atmosphere. So as a result, various colors of light are absorbed from the sun's atmosphere, and we get a spectrum that looks kind of like that. We saw the same effect from the coating that you can see, the kind of bluish coating that you can see on those Revere bulbs that absorb the the yellow light that was produced by the filament was absent once the light had gone through that kind of bluish coating. Okay, so there are lots of names for these things. Continuous spectra is just referring to the fact that there's more or less the same amount of light at neighboring wavelengths. Our book calls these things black bodies, which I think is confusing because usually you don't think of the sun as being a black body, but technically speaking it is. Thermal is a name I like. Planck is the name of the guy who actually found the formula for the curve. So all of those are equally good names. Emission spectra, that's what we've been calling it. Another name for that is bright line spectra. And the idea is that if you, as we did yesterday looking through the spectroscopes, what you saw is kind of a sequence of bright lines in this sort of case, right? So there's not much light at that particular wavelength, but as we sweep in wavelength, we reach a particular color at which there's lots of light, and then there's not much light again. So things like this are called bright line spectra or emission spectra. And kind of contrary-wise, you can see from the diagram for the sun, a logical name for that is dark line spectra, because we have particular wavelengths at which there doesn't seem to be as much light as there should. But absorption spectra is a pretty good name. We saw that different elements produce different colors of light, right? So that's a color that's kind of famous. That's a neon light bulb. But if I change the element that's being excited, so this is nitrogen, it's a different color. The sodium light bulbs that are often used for parking lot illumination kind of have a yellowish glow. So every element has a particular set of wavelengths that it emits. And so we can actually figure out what the element is by doing the experiment in our laboratory where we know what the element is and then comparing that to the light we see from stars. So if we see starlight that has an absorption at 6021.216, and we find out that exactly that same wavelength is produced by kryptonite, then we can guess that there's kryptonite in that star. Assuming we can get a hold of kryptonite in our laboratories. Okay. So for a continuous spectra, the source is any thick object, thick enough that it's not transparent. Any thick object that has a temperature, which is most any object, is producing a continuous spectra. Excited transparent gases are good examples of what's producing an emission line spectra. So before I turn on the electricity, it just looks like there's nothing inside that bulb, right? It just looks white. It looks transparent. But when I excite the gas, that's when I see these emission lines. And to produce an absorption line spectra, we want something that's doing the absorbing in front of a continuous source. questions on spectra. So how'd the spectra quiz go online? It's usually problematic.
It doesn't actually tell you how you did.
No, it doesn't. But I'll give you the printout next time we meet. Is that a question, Ben?
Yeah, how do the bulbs burn out? How do bulbs actually burn out? I know these ones are called braids, but like...
Okay, so for these guys here, you're right. What happens over time is that the tungsten is hot enough that it evaporates, so it gets thinner and thinner and thinner, and finally it breaks. And then we can't have electrical current flowing through it, so it's broken. These things here fail in a much subtler way. In some sense, there isn't a filament in there. That is to say, I hope to get to it today exactly how these things work, but basically how they work is just that there is high-speed electrons that are running into the atoms inside that gas, and that's what's causing the excitation, which is then producing this light. So the way these bulbs fail is usually a little bit subtler, and the... So one sign that you've seen a failed bulb is it'll often look black on the outside, on the ends near the electrodes. Is that a question here?
You can keep going with his.
And so something is evaporating, but it's not exactly a filament. In order to make the... Okay, so let's draw kind of a picture. So we have this tube, and there are electrodes that are going to be the source of these high-speed electrons. And it turns out that for normal sorts of materials, the electrons don't particularly like to leave that metal. They're happy sitting inside of it. But there are certain coatings that you can put on metal that make it more likely for them to be emitted. So the technical statement is it reduces the work function. And that coating is what typically evaporates and makes the black stuff. And when the coating is gone, then the tube doesn't work as well. So nothing is used, I guess you could say that this coating is used up, but it's not really fundamental to the light making process. But it makes the electrons that make the light, and so when it gets used up, it's problematical. But you could take these tubes, and just by putting them under even higher voltage, they would start to work again. They kind of have to work at 120 volts, which is why they need these coatings. These guys here are operating under 5,000 volts, and they don't have those sort of coatings. These things fail too, but there it's probably the gas leaking out of the tube. More questions?
It has to do with the quiz, and I don't know if you might have mentioned it, but part of the order where I was kind of confused is like what the wavelengths look like when a star would be farther away, or how everything kind of, all the I think it was like the last like six questions. I think you can kind of go over that.
Shall we take a look at it?
Yeah.
Why not? So basically, while this thing's warming up, basically the idea is that the only effect of moving a star further away is it's going to be dimmer. So we're going to see less light, right? So all that's going to do is move the curve uniformly down. So we'll get half as much light, say, at every possible wavelength. So changing the temperature of a star, that's going to be shifting the peaks and raising it up. But... Okay. If you've looked ahead at the next quiz, then that has more to do with kind of the spectroscope. So I'm not sure I want to go through all of these questions, but I think that it was somewhere around here. Is this down further? Oh, these multiple ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So... Yeah, you want to hit the lights for me? So these questions are set up saying that this is what we had originally, and then we make a change, and the question is which one of these spectra are going to work, and we always have this option of none of the above, which is the scary option. So if we enlarge the radius of the star, the temperature isn't going to change, but we're going to have more light because we've got more star. So we're expecting the whole thing is just going to be bigger. So it's kind of hard to see what bigger is, but here this thing is starting at 50 at its maximum, and this thing is at 70 at its maximum. Whereas this thing is lower than 50, this thing has a shifted peak, and this thing has a shifted peak. So we got A, right? Further from Earth, so it should have the same shape, but just dimmer at every wavelength. So the peak should occur at the same spot, but we should just have less light at every wavelength. So B is the one. Right, these guys have shifted peaks, which indicate different temperature. You're looking confused. You're not happy.
I'm just kind of like trying to remember what I put and like my reasoning for it. So you just keep going.
I'll keep going, huh? Never mind that it doesn't look like I'm achieving anything. Okay, so if we reduce the temperature, then it's the usual story, right? We're going to see less light at every wavelength, and we're going to have a shifted peak. So the previous peak was at 1 micron. This is the only one that has a peak that shifted to longer wavelengths. So this guy has less light at every wavelength, and the peak shifted. So that one's D. Increase in temperature. So increase in temperature is going to have a peak shifted to shorter wavelengths. So C is looking good, but C doesn't have more light. It has about the same amount of light. So this guy is E, none of the above. But if we increase the temperature, which would make it bigger every place and shift the peak, and then move it further away, then it could be all set up to be C. Joe's smiling, and I think it's not because he knows all these answers. Usually people have a lot of trouble with the ratio type stuff. Did that work okay for people? Okay. It's in some sense simple, right? You're just reading this graph and looking at ratios of numbers, right? So the amount of blue light, I think I said it was 0.45, so we would just go up and we'd read over, right? Yes? No? And then I think down someplace I ask you what the ratio is. So here we're looking at the amount of blue light compared to the amount of red light. So for red light, obviously there's lots more red light than there is blue light. And I would just take the ratio then of those numbers that I get from going up and over for red light and going up and over for blue light. And if you forget, the definition of what I meant by red light was up here at the top. Other questions? So maybe it'll be reassuring. I think this quiz is harder than the typical exam questions. I just wanted to make sure for this quiz that you kind of understood what the axes meant. And more for the exam, I'm asking you to draw pictures and understand pictures like this about how things change, as opposed to details like I did sometimes here. More questions? Okay, so spectra, real important topic. The only thing we have from stars is light, and so we're going to learn everything about the stars by looking at their spectra, so it's important to understand how they work. We also talked about how to make light, and the bottom line on all of this is that we make light by having accelerated electrical charge. In the case of a radio antenna, we have a wire and we're sending electrons up and down that wire, so they're accelerated. In the case of your microwave oven, there's a magnetic field and the electrons are going around in a circle, and that's what's making the microwave light. In the case of X-ray light, what you do is you accelerate the electrons to speeds close to the speed of light, and then you bash them into a piece of copper. So they deaccelerate suddenly, and that's what makes German braking radiation, Bremsstrahlung. So we've left out lots of things. We've left out the cause of the emission lines, and we've left out gamma rays. And that's going to be the topic today, but kind of for completeness sake, you'll learn that that has to do with quantum leaps. And basically what happens with gamma ray radiation has to do with nuclei in the same sense that what emission spectra is has to do with atoms.
So you get an X-ray done, like do they take like a picture like right in like the electron, like Bremsstrahl?
Yeah, so they turn on the Bremsstrahl source so that X-rays are going through your body, and then the film records what made it through. And X-rays are material that are particularly stopped by things that are far down the periodic table. So it goes through flesh pretty well, which is mostly carbon and oxygen and nitrogen, stuff near the top of the periodic table. But the calcium and such that's in your bones stops the X-rays to a greater extent. Right? Lead, even further down the periodic table, stops them even better. Yeah, so that's protecting the rest of your flesh from those X-rays. Because they don't go in exactly a straight line. They kind of come out in a variety of directions. And they try and shield the source so that it's mostly aimed at your mouth, but you notice the person who's operating the machine usually leaves the room, right? Because they're continually subjected to it. And any amount of, so best guess is that any amount of radiation increases your chance of getting cancer. So anytime you get an extra X-ray, you know, infinitesimally your chance, you know, it's like smoking one cigarette or something, infinitesimally your chance of getting cancer has been increased. So maybe smoking one cigarette is okay, but a lifetime of smoking is probably a bad idea. More questions? Okay, so then we kind of change topic, and we're kind of working towards trying to understand how these fluorescent light bulbs work. And we wanted to talk about matter. And actually, earlier we had talked about the states of matter. We had that kind of cheesy cartoon where I could change the temperature of water, start as ice, make it liquid, make it gas, and break apart the atoms to make it a plasma. So as we increase the temperature, we get more disordered kinetic energy. Kind of the mantra for this class is that high temperatures break apart composites. So we start with a solid, which, you know, is one big composite. Every atom is connected to every other atom. And we end up with the H and the O broken apart even, and the electrons stripped from the nuclei. If we wanted to make kind of a big deal about all of this, which we really don't, we could introduce Gibbs free energy, which is this equation. And what this equation says is that at low temperatures, systems want to be in the lowest possible energy state. Whereas at high temperatures, systems want to have the greatest possible disorder. So if we have composites, we can have a lot more disorder if we break apart those composites. So that's fundamentally why high temperatures result in anything that's made out of subpieces having those subpieces broken apart. Questions? Okay, so kind of in the context of states of matter, once we've discussed the differences between solids, liquids, and gases, kind of the most elementary piece of a material is going to be a molecule. And we've said, you know, for example, H2O, we've got the oxygen molecule, excuse me, the oxygen atom and the hydrogen atoms, and kind of the Mickey Mouse picture of what that molecule looks like. And there are obviously way more complicated molecules like glucose. So this is a whole sequence of, that's a six, that's a whole sequence of atoms that are all linked together. And usually these things are denoted by, well, for example, I don't want to go all the way to methane. Usually kind of the picture you should have of an atom, at least to start with, is something that has hooks, and those hooks can hook together to form combinations which are molecules. And these hooks, I'm sure you learned in high school, are chemical bonds. Okay, so molecules are composites of atoms. What's an atom? So, circa 1910, Rutherford came to the conclusion that atoms consisted of a electrically positively charged and massive nuclei. With electrons that are orbiting around it. So the word atom actually goes back to the Greeks, and the idea that an atom has substructure would be anathema to the Greeks, right? Atoms were supposed to be indestructible things, and they couldn't be taken apart. And what we call atoms can be taken apart and aren't exactly indestructible, but they're fairly indestructible. So that we can talk about, you know, for example, the carbon cycle, the what you ate for breakfast may have been dinosaur shit 65 million years ago, or you know, pieces of bugs, every imaginable sort of thing, right? The atoms are, roughly speaking, immortal. So they've always been on this planet, and they've been parts of various typically living beings if we're talking about carbon. But they might have been deposited as coal for a while, too. Okay. But here we have an atom that has substructure and can be broken apart at least a little bit. And that's one kind of unusual feature about this atom. And I don't know, in 15 minutes or more, I'll tell you that there are various things that are impossible about this atom. And that led to big problems. Okay, but let's go smaller. So if we look inside this electron, what's inside of it? And the best evidence currently is that there's nothing inside of it. That is to say that the electron is elementary. There's nothing to break apart inside of an electron. In contrast to the nucleus. So if we look at this nucleus in detail, what we think we would see is individual protons and neutrons cheek to jowl inside this nucleus. So a proton, that's exactly the same thing as a hydrogen nucleus. It's a positively charged massive object that we'll talk about in greater detail in a second. And neutrons, so neutrons were discovered circa 1930. They're pretty hard to detect. These things are electrically neutral. So for example, carbon, the nucleus of carbon, that has 6 protons and 6 neutrons all bound together. And I'm sure I won't get the numbers exactly right, but uranium has something like 92 protons and something like 140 neutrons. Normal garden variety hydrogen, the nucleus, is just a proton. But about 1% of garden variety hydrogen, the nucleus consists of a proton and a neutron stuck together. So that's sometimes called heavy hydrogen or deuterium. But if you were to drink water that had deuterium in it as opposed to normal hydrogen, it would taste just like water, it'd act just like water. Not a big difference. There's another variety of hydrogen that has 1 proton and 2 neutrons in it. This is called tritium. And it's radioactive. You wouldn't want to drink this stuff. It decays in about 15 years. So it's a relatively rare isotope of hydrogen. So these various types of the chemical hydrogen are called isotopes. What determines the chemical nature of the atom is the number of protons. So all of these guys had exactly one proton. That's what made them hydrogen. What makes helium is having exactly two protons, and you might have one neutron or two neutrons or maybe three neutrons in there. Carbon, the most common form, has six protons and six neutrons, but again, about 1% of it has six protons and seven neutrons. Carbon-13. You eat meat that's made out of carbon-13, it's going to taste just like carbon. A small percentage of carbon is radioactive carbon, and it has six protons, of course. You need six protons in order to be carbon, and it has eight neutrons. Okay, so the chemical elements we know come in various isotopes where we have various numbers of neutrons in the nucleus, and it's kind of no import. Chemically, these guys would act pretty much the same. If we have far from the normal number of neutrons, then the nucleus would be radioactive, meaning that it would spontaneously decay into something else. Okay, so molecules, atoms. Inside an atom, we've got a nucleus and an electron. The nucleus has protons and neutrons. What if we look inside of the protons? So if we look inside the protons, we find three quarks. So inside of a proton, there are two up quarks and a down quark. Inside of a neutron, there are two down quarks and an up quark. All bound closely together. Well, what's inside these quarks? Well, as far as we can see so far, there's nothing inside of them. You know, but to say that, of course, as you build better and better microscopes, although microscopes tend to be huge things like the Hadron Collider outside of Geneva, as you build things that allow you to see smaller and smaller details, you might discover new things inside of these previously so-called elementary particles. There are lots of people who think that there is stuff inside electrons and quarks, and they think that those things have little tiny string loops that are inside of those guys. But there's no current evidence for that. It just kind of makes a nice theory. So best evidence now is that there are just elementary electrons and elementary quarks. Question?
Does that have anything to do with the string theory?
Yep.
So can you explain that a little?
Can I explain string theory?
Like the basis, like not explain, like I don't know, like I just heard people talk about string theory. I don't know, like,
brief summary.
Like brief.
Well, it would be, as you might guess, a long story, right? So the first and I think most important thing to recognize about string theory is there's no reason to believe it. Okay, nevertheless, there are lots of people who want to believe it. So the question is why? Why do they care about this theory for which there's no observations that support it? So it's a mathematically nice theory. You know, and people, particularly physicists, are attracted to kind of beautiful mathematics, and the mathematics in string theory is beautiful. Okay, well, that's maybe one reason for it. So I'm kind of jumping a little bit ahead of what I want to say. The other thing that's very nice about string theory is that we'll learn that there are four forces of nature, exactly four, and one of those forces is gravity. And you may know that Einstein did important work in 1905, and then he replaced Newton's theory of gravity in about 1910. But attempts to put gravity on the same level as the other theories have been a consistent failure. It is what Einstein spent the rest of his life trying to do without success, to so-called unify all of the forces so he could understand some common feature of electricity and magnetism and the nuclear force. And string theory shows signs that it might do that, but it's a singular, no, they're hints. So I might say string theory, but string theory isn't actually a thing. It's more like a hope. And it's been a disappointment. So I can remember in 1980 reading string theorists telling me that everything would be explained next year, that you know the progress was going to be that rapid. And in fact, nothing has been explained. So one theory has been replaced by the next and the next, and more complications have been found. So it turns out that my personal career kind of ended my education ended before string theory, just before string theory started to take off. So I studied strings, but not these particular strings. And as a result, I've been a little bit skeptical of it from the start. But it's an attractive theory that has no experimental support. It's about the only way that people know of to make gravity look like other forces, but there are zillions of problems with it. And so now 30 years of attempts to make something out of it have not gotten any place. So my money's, well, I don't want to put any money on it, or for it or against it, I guess. It's kind of the only, so there are other candidate ways of doing this too, but I like those even less than I like string theory. But I don't really like string theory either. Well, so there's a theory that explains everything that we have measured. But it's a theory in which gravity is kind of left out. And the name of this theory is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. And I'll explain more about what's involved in those letters, but and this is a gauge theory. Incidentally, in some sense, string theory is also a gauge theory. So that's the one that everyone, there is no experimental evidence that disagrees with this theory. Almost certainly it will be improved, but all current experiments are in accord with the predictions. And that's been the case for 30 years, and it's been an incredible 30 years. If you look at the previous 30 years, there are a whole sequence of, so we're talking from 1950 to 1980, there are a huge number of theories that were just destroyed one after another when people turned on new colliders to look at more and more energetic collisions. And I can remember taking a class, an early class in this sort of stuff, in which the professor said, well, quarks are currently in favor, but I don't think they'll last out the year. Well, no, he was wrong. They have lasted for 30 years. So the current theory is more successful than any other theory has ever been in the area of particle physics, lasting for 30 years, whereas before, kind of the average lifetime has been maybe 2 years. So it's extremely successful, works really well. It's got to be wrong. Even I think that. But it's possible to be wrong and still very useful, as we'll talk about more today, I guess. More questions? Okay, so we've got a periodic table of the elements, which shows all the atoms that we know, and more nuclei are created occasionally, but they're not particularly important, that talks about all of their properties. How about a periodic table of the actual atoms of these apparently elementary particles, these quarks and things that are called electrons? So it turns out that an electron is not the only thing that's like an electron. There are things that are just like an electron, except they weigh more. And they are called the muon and the tau. And it's And it turns out that for each one of these particles, there is a particle that is just like it, except it lacks electrical charge. It's electrically neutral. So these are called neutrinos. And people haven't bothered to give a different name for the muon neutrino and the tau neutrino. They just call it the muon neutrino and the tau neutrino. And we kind of put these things together in the following way, which may not, I don't know if you'll be pleased with that or not. So we have a neutrino, and we have an electron, and we have a different neutrino and a muon, and we have a third neutrino and a tau. And these doublets seem to be identical. That is to say, if you act on a muon, it acts just like an electron, except it weighs more. It weighs about 200 times as much as an electron, and the tau weighs, 50 times more than the muon. In the same way, so far we have met up quarks and down quarks. And it turns out that there's a repetition of this pattern. There's a charmed quark and, there's a charmed quark and a strange quark, and there's a top quark and a bottom quark. And these guys seem to be identical to the other quarks, except they weigh more. All of these guys have a charge that is plus 2/3, and all of these guys have a charge that is 1 unit less, which is minus 1/3. And of course, the same thing is true here. All of these guys have a charge of 0, and all of these guys have a charge that is 1 unit less, namely minus 1. So this set of three doublets doubled seems to be the kind of new version of the periodic table, right? So these are ever more massive versions of some sort of thing. So these things are called quarks. We need kind of a collective name here. They're called leptons. So what's the difference between the quarks and the leptons? Well, I guess I'll hold off on that for a second. So this seems to be the stuff of the universe. How about the forces? So I think I said 5 minutes ago that in 5 minutes I would talk about four forces. So as far as we can tell, there are four fundamental forces. And gravity, of course, is perhaps the most obvious force. The next force you may think about as being cheating. It's electricity and magnetism. So in about 1860, the physicist Maxwell showed that magnetism was just a type of electricity, and he wrote down the set of equations that govern both electricity and magnetism. Well, if we jump back to the nucleus, there's kind of a problem that needs to be explained, right? So inside of a carbon nucleus, we have six protons, and they all have positive charges, so they're repelled by each other. So what's holding them together? Right? If they're actually staying in the nucleus, there has to be a counterbalancing force that's sticking those things together. Is that a question, Ben? Or? Say again?
Do the electrons
then keep it? Nope. So you can strip the electrons out of an atom and the nucleus still holds together just fine. Say again? Well, the neutrons are electrically neutral, so at least seemingly by themselves, they're not going to help. But it does seem that the neutrons are necessary. So you may have noticed that roughly speaking, there are as many neutrons as protons. And if you try and remove neutrons from a nucleus, it'll eventually become unstable. So the neutrons seem to be a necessary feature for a stable nucleus, but I don't think they exactly explain themselves what's going on. We need some sort of force that is actually making positively charged things attract each other. So all we need to do is to give it a name. We're going to call it the nuclear force. And actually, the problem just becomes more complicated when we think about inside of this proton, right? So inside of this proton, there are quarks, some of which have positive charges, some of which have negative charges. What keeps those quarks together? Well, just because they balance out doesn't mean they aren't going to repel. So what you're going to have is that these guys are going to repel each other, but the down quark, since it's negatively charged, is going to be attracted to those two up quarks. But if you take things like that, you know, if you take little pith balls and charge two of them positive and one negative, they fly apart. They don't stay together. So we need something to hold the protons and the neutrons inside the nucleus, and we need something to hold the quarks together inside of a proton and a neutron. And that's what the nuclear force does. So mostly, the strongest version of the nuclear force is what's holding the quarks together, and kind of a leftover small version of that is what's holding the protons and the neutrons together inside of a nucleus. And the last force, which I'll give a name for, the weak force, so the weak force is so weak, it's not usually experienced as a push or a pull, it's experienced as a change in the nature of the atom. So it turns out that if you have a neutron that is just sitting around free, and you wait about 1,000 seconds, what happens is it becomes a proton and an antimatter, excuse me, and an electron and a neutrino. And of course, fundamentally what's happening in this process is that one of the down quarks, inside of this neutron is becoming an up quark and in the process emitting an electron and a neutrino. So this transformation that ties a switch between those two guys to these two guys, that's the weak force. It mostly causes, seemingly causes transformations. It can cause pushes or pulls, but it's most obvious in this transformative process. So this is sometimes called nuclear decay. So you remember that light is fundamentally made out of electricity and magnetism. And so you might guess that there ought to be something that's made out of the nuclear force that is kind of like light. And you might guess that there's something that's made out of the weak force and is kind of like light. And all of those things are true. So this was the photon. The strong force, the corresponding particles are called gluons. They're needed to glue together the quarks. And for the weak force, we just have letters. So there are three particles, the positively charged W, the negatively charged W, and the Z. Turns out there are 8 gluons, 1 photon, and you can see 3 of these guys. So these particles are called gauge bosons. And they are the particle that is made out of the force. And so conceivably they can travel through vacuum. Those are all detected particles. There should be a wave that's made out of gravity, and we have a name all set for it. It's going to be called the graviton. And I kind of don't know whether to tell you it's been detected or not detected. It's been detected indirectly, and I'm fully satisfied with it being detected. But people are trying to make a more direct detection of the graviton, which is extremely weakly interacting. It takes huge things in order to detect them, and it takes huge things to make them. So think about black holes colliding or something like that in order to make enough gravitons that we could actually detect on Earth. Okay, so I gave you that name, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. How does those things match up? So the force that is holding the quarks together, sometimes called the color force, that's related to what's called SU3. The force that is causes nuclear decay is called SU2, and electricity and magnetism is the U1. So there have been Nobel Prizes for figuring out all of this stuff. And things were pretty well set by 1980. Question? We have good reason to suspect. So the periodic table grows occasionally as people discover extremely fast decaying nuclei that they create in particle accelerators. We have good reason to expect that this is the entire periodic table of the elementary particles, that there can be nothing to add to this list. And the name kind of tells you something, right? So the strange quark came about as an oddity, and when people discovered the charm quark, it all started to make sense. And by that time, these things were just dull, so we just called them top and bottom. So there was basically a Nobel Prize for discovering the charmed quark.
How do they come up with the name charmed?
So because it was charming.
Oh.
So if you have three quarks, and that was the situation in 1970, you kind of have we have one full puzzle piece and one broken puzzle piece. And so people were trying to put those pieces together and they just didn't fit. But once somebody saw that there was a particle just like the up quark that went along with the charm quark, then we had two examples. And it was pretty clear how things would work. And people postulated then that there would be more examples to make the top and the bottom. And there were, and then it was discovered that there are good reasons for that being the entire list. Okay, questions? Okay, so molecules, atoms, electrons and nuclei, protons and neutrons, quarks, that's the stuff that we know about. And at the end of this course, I'll tell you that that's a small fraction of what the universe is made out of. But that's mostly honesty at this point. It's everything we know about, but apparently the universe is mostly made out of stuff we don't know about. So the nuclear atom, I think that's 1911, and then kind of the final versions of this theory are 1980 or so. The first hint about electricity and magnetism, which is actually the clue to how it all works. Electricity and magnetism was the first gauge theory. That's Maxwell in 1860. So, you know, roughly speaking, a century of a work to figure that out. Now we've got a big problem that was evident immediately. So wasn't in some sense new, and it goes back to the nuclear atom. The nuclear atom can't be true, or at least things have to be weirdly different. So you remember the picture we have, you know, going back to high school, we've got a nucleus, we've got electrons that are orbiting around, kind of like a junior version of the solar system, where instead of having gravity hold this whole thing together, it's the electric force that's holding it all together. our solar system is planar, but we're not thinking that this is planar. These electrons are orbiting in every conceivable possible orbit. But it can't be the case. Question? Yeah, so I'm getting to that. So this can't be this is pretty much exactly what Rutherford said, knowing that it couldn't be this way, but it's what it appeared to be, a junior version of the solar system. And why it can't be this way is because of this. Accelerated charge is supposed to produce light. So here we have electrons that are going around in circles, and these electrons are moving at about 1% of the speed of light. So they're going really fast. They should be constantly emitting light. And by conservation of energy, if you're emitting light, that energy has to come from someplace. So just as this rock falls, this piece of chalk falls down as I drop it, if we're producing energy, then it must be that the whole atom is getting more and more collapsed. And you can calculate how long it takes for an atom to collapse, and it turns out about a billionth of a second. So we all know that atoms have been around for more than a billionth of a second, so this picture has to be wrong. There has to be something fundamentally flawed about it. And from Rutherford's point of view, it stands on extremely firm foundation, right? Newton explained how mechanics work, and Maxwell had explained how electricity and magnetism work. Those were extremely well-tested theories, but they're in contradiction to this picture of the nuclear atom. So kind of what's supposed to give? And it was kind of surprising that what had to give was the thing that was best tested. So in 1910, Maxwell's theory was kind of the new kid on the block. It had only been around for 50 years, whereas Newton's theory had been around since 1689. It had been extremely well tested in the solar system and lots of other ways, but turns out that Newton has it wrong. So remember, the basic idea of Newtonian mechanics, which is sometimes called classical mechanics, is that particles, generally speaking, are going to move forever in a straight line. If there are forces on them, then they're going to change their velocity according to the action of that force. And of course, we have action, reaction, and the law of gravity. So something's wrong with that formulation. And it turns out it's wrong right from the get-go. So Newton thought in terms of atoms the way the Greeks had from the start. So he thought about matter being made out of these little massy particles that were eternal, you know, so that the breasts that Christ made 2,000 years ago, those particles are still with us. And you're still breathing them in and putting them out. And those particles have positions that you can measure, and those particles have velocities and all of those sort of situations. And it turns out that while we have a name for this idea of particles, they don't exist. And what I mean by that is that you can't give a position and a velocity to an object. It just turns out not to make sense. And of course, we also have waves. So I've been talking about electromagnetic waves. And it turns out that electromagnetic waves, photons, don't exist the way that we're thinking that they do. So it turns out there's kind of an odd history in that. Newton thought that light was made out of particles, and then in the 1800s there were experiments that showed that they were waves, and now I'm telling you that they're not either. That these words that we have are words for things that actually don't exist. And what does exist is one sort of thing. So it's not that the universe is made out of particles and waves. The universe is made out of one sort of thing, and we just don't have a name for it. We call it a wave particle. I don't know. There isn't a nice name for it. But apparently light and electrons and gravity waves, all of these things really probably act exactly the same way. They're not really different things. So the usual story at this point is to talk about the story about the blind men and the elephant, right? So you can imagine five blind men looking at an elephant, and somebody says, well, elephants are kind of like walls, right? Because there's this big slab of things. Somebody feels the legs and says, well, elephants are kind of like trees. Somebody feels the trunk and says, elephants are kind of like snakes. Somebody feels the leaves and says, somebody feels the ears and says, elephants are kind of like palm leaves. And somebody feels the tail and says that they're more like sticks. So you might say that an elephant is kind of the simultaneous combination of all of those things. But the elephant is an elephant, right? It's not really all of those things at the same time. And that's the same thing that's going on with this wave particle. So if we play with electrons or light, sometimes they act like particles to our point of view, and sometimes they act like waves, but it's kind of a mistake to say that they're kind of simultaneously both. They're their own thing. And what's kind of funny about this situation is I can describe exactly how these things act mathematically, but I don't have a vocabulary for it. And the reason I don't have a vocabulary for it is that all of our vocabulary matches what Newton said. Right? We think about baseballs being particles. We have words for particles because they seem to exist, but in fact, they don't exist. And if we get to a small enough scale, things act weirdly enough that it becomes evident that the Newtonian picture has to be wrong. So, if this is wrong, what's right? And the answer is called quantum mechanics. And it was developed, I think I'll say around 1925. And the names that are usually associated with it are Schrödinger. I don't care about these names, they won't occur on an exam. And Heisenberg. Much earlier, Bohr kind of started the game, but he didn't kind of see the end of it. So this is a new way of thinking about how things move that is radically different, because it's not based on things having positions. It's based on the mathematical properties of wave particles, and it makes perfectly good predictions. So if electrons don't have positions, if you look closely enough, it's not fair to say that this electron could be orbiting the way a planet is, because the electron doesn't have a position. It's not a particle. So we have to think about this electron as kind of being simultaneously every place. So often this is described then as a cloud. But a cloud is made out of individual droplets, and this is not made out of individual droplets. This is made out of one electron. And so it's an electron that is somehow simultaneously present at all those positions. And while the electron has kinetic energy, this cloud is static. It's not changing in time. And so we don't have to worry about charge moving, because that cloud is constantly there. So there's no accelerated charge, so there's no emission of light. So we have kind of a standing wave is the technical word for it, a standing wave of electron probability that's pulsing. I use the word pulsing, but it's not a good word. that is sitting there around this nucleus. And it turns out that just as with a musical instrument, there are lots of ways that it can produce sound, there are lots of these electron wave particle states that can simultaneously exist. So, instead of thinking about orbits, sometimes you hear this word orbitals. And basically the idea is that there are a handful of possible ways that an electron can sit simultaneously around this nucleus. So these are kind of old-fashioned names, orbitals, shells. But kind of overall is the idea is energy levels or states. Let's go back for a second and talk about this word quantum, because it's in contrast to the usual ideas of Newtonian mechanics. So if we're thinking about this as a particle, it can be in all possible positions. If it moves between 1 and 2, it was at every position between 1 and 2 at some time. Now, another way you could imagine that, and the Greeks actually had problems with this, leading to things called Zeno's paradoxes, is that maybe things come along in little steps. Maybe what seems to be continuous motion is actually a series of kind of microscopic steps. So quantum is referring to the idea that instead of there being a continuous version of things, things actually come in probably pretty small steps. And that seems to be the case for these orbits. For planets, they seem to be able to orbit at any conceivable radius. But the claim is for these electrons, they can't orbit just any place. They're just a handful of ways they can orbit. And those are the energy states or energy levels. The further out the electron cloud is on average, the higher the energy of the corresponding state. Right, so if you took some chemistry, you might have learned things like 1s and 2s and 2p and 3d and that sort of thing. Those are all just names for these various energy states. And we don't care about the names for them. The idea is that there are just certain possible ways that an electron can orbit the nucleus. There's a lowest possible state where the electron is as close to the nucleus as it can ever get. We call that the ground state. Everything else is called an excited state. So we can have an electron kind of like Pluto, way out from the nucleus. We can have an electron that's like Mercury, that's close to the nucleus. But we can't have literally everything in between. There are a handful of possibilities. And it's just not possible to orbit here. It's only possible to orbit at these relative handful of states. Okay, so it's radically different from Newtonian mechanics, where everything is continuous, all possibilities are open. Here we have only a few possibilities. So obviously we're going to come back to this next time, but let's get to the punchline. Quantum leaps. And aside from the name of a bad television show, what is it talking about? It's talking about the possibility of an electron going from one of these orbitals to another one of these orbitals, from one cloud configuration to another cloud configuration. And it turns out, if you do the math, that if you go from one configuration to another, there is a period of time when that electron charge distribution is oscillating, and it will then produce light. So light is produced in these transitions between one set of states and another. So as the electron makes this leap from one cloud state to another cloud state, that's when the light is emitted. And there's a relationship between the energy of light and the corresponding frequency. The bigger the energy jump, the higher the frequency of light that is produced. So different leaps are going to have different amounts of energy associated with them. They're going to produce different frequencies, which is to say wavelengths of light. So for every one of these individual colors of light that is produced in one of these emission spectra, there's a corresponding jump that has just the right amount of energy for that frequency. And the reason that this color of light isn't produced is because there is no energy jump that corresponds to that particular frequency of light. Okay, so I guess we call it quits.